It is now nearly 6 months since the Hamas assault on southern Israel claimed more than 1,200 lives. It's thought that as many as 100 people are still hostage in Gaza, and that the remains of 30 other Israelis are there as well. The Israeli counterattack aimed at dismantling Hamas has, according to Israeli claims, killed a significant share of Hamas fighters. They say well over 10,000, including several leaders. But it has also claimed the lives of many Palestinians who were not associated with that assault. The Palestinians claim that all told, more than 30,000 Gazans have been killed, half of them under the age of 18. In this hour, we're going to hear from three very knowledgeable experts. But first, we're going to check in with Dr. Felix Benninger of Rabin Medical Center, where he is a professor of neurology. Dr. Felix Benninger, good to see you again, and thank you for joining us.
Good to see you, too. Thank you for inviting me.
We're checking in on what more than 5 months of war have meant for the medical center. How would you describe its effect on life at the hospital?
Of course, all the events in October 7th was affecting us in daily life in the hospital. First of all, we had a huge amount of injured, which were treated in our hospital at the moment, together with civilians, which were in the 7th of October attack, and soldiers. We had more than 850 admissions, which are in addition to our regular admissions at the hospital, and more than 350 immediate surgeries with helicopters arriving almost daily, especially through November, December. What is very strenuous for the hospital is, of course, the military service and doctors, nurses, and other staff which were pulled into military service. So 158 members of our hospital were drafted into the military, and this includes 90 doctors, which was, of course, very strenuous for the hospital itself. There were a couple of wards which could not function normally, and we had to switch to 12-hour shifts for the medical staff.
Your specialty is epilepsy, and I confess in my medical ignorance, I didn't assume that there would be as much of an impact on your field as there would be on a burn unit or orthopedic surgery department. But actually, as you've explained to me, there is a very strong connection between combat and epilepsy.
Yes, this is true. So this is actually, as you say, in the beginning months, October, November, my specialty was not very much involved in treating directly soldiers or wounded. And then about a month, 2 months later, after the 7th of October, we saw that patients, especially soldiers with head injuries, a significant amount started to have epileptic seizures due to the head injuries. This is something known, which also from a car accidents, from other injuries. But of course, during this fighting, during the war and the injured, we had many more young people suddenly with severe head injuries treated neurosurgically. And then later on, when they were in rehabilitation at our center, developed seizures and had to be treated medically for this condition. And we very much hope that this is not turning into a chronic disease, as we see many times in post-TBI, as we call it, post-TBI epilepsy. The situation is very difficult, still ongoing.
Well, Dr. Benninger, Felix Benninger, it's good to talk with you. And thank you so much for what you do at the medical center and for talking with us today about it. Now we turn to Ambassador Dennis Ross, who spent years working for both Republican and Democratic administrations trying to negotiate an end to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. We're talking about the war in Gaza and the diplomatic and political efforts to reach some kind of ceasefire, if not a long-term resolution. And Ambassador Dennis Ross, thank you very much for joining us today. We have a war in Gaza that Israel says isn't finished. The U.S. has differences with Israel over the prospect of an offensive in Rafah, the city at the southern end of the Gaza Strip. The negotiations for a pause in the fighting and some kind of partial hostage return have not succeeded so far. What should the U.S. be doing right now? And should that include placing conditions on military aid to Israel?
Well, I wouldn't place conditions on military aid to Israel for a lot of reasons. I think you have a country that's still experiencing trauma, literally a country that's dealing with post-traumatic stress syndrome. The last thing that is important would be for Israelis to somehow feel that they're really alone when it comes to the United States, because there's nobody else that's supportive of Israel. I think the U.S. is doing what it should be doing in terms of, on the one hand, trying to help to get a hostage deal that at least can provide a pause of 6 weeks. It's doing what it should be doing in terms of trying to ensure that Israel does a better job when it comes to humanitarian assistance getting into Gaza, that the U.S. organizes others to help ensure that it gets there. I think it needs to think more about, as does Israel, about how do you secure the delivery of assistance that you get into Gaza. From the very beginning, Israel's time and space that it needs to be able to deal with the military threat of Gaza. And I put it in the category of what the real objective of Israel should be, which is the demilitarization of Gaza. The idea that you're going to have total victory is an illusion, because you're not going to eliminate Hamas any more than we were able to eliminate ISIS. But you can demilitarize Gaza. You can succeed in demilitarizing Hamas. And if you achieve that, and if the administration reaches an agreement with the Israelis on what's the level you need to achieve, then you have not only a measure of success, but you then also can focus on what are the mechanisms you need to put in place to ensure that there can't be a remilitarization of Gaza. So I focus very heavily on what I think the administration can be doing, especially in regard to that, because there should be a kind of basic bargain. Ultimately, there can't be reconstruction of Gaza until there can be guaranteed demilitarization of Gaza. And no one is going to invest in Gaza as a donor if Hamas somehow can still be in political control, because they'll do this all over again.
You spent the better part of a career trying to midwife a two-state solution. I just wonder what you make of the calls nowadays, reminding us, trying to get Israel and the Palestinians back on track toward a two-state solution. After this war, realistically, are compromises that were out of reach in much better times conceivably within reach now, after the attacks of October 7th and the Israeli response in Gaza?
The answer is no. You have two different universes in terms of Israelis feeling this enormous sense of trauma, this collective sense of loss, a perception that if there were a Palestinian state, it would be led by Hamas. So they can't contemplate concessions to the Palestinians right now. Palestinians are suffering their own trauma because of the consequences of the level of death and destruction in Gaza. So they can't contemplate any kind of concessions to the Israelis. So the idea of preserving two states as an eventual outcome, I think, remains important, because a one-state outcome is a prescription for guaranteed perpetual conflict and war between Israelis and Palestinians. You have two national identities, two national movements competing for the same space. Those identities are not going to disappear. They're not going to coexist in one state. But you're also not in a position now where you can move from where we are to a two-state outcome. So you need to focus on how do you build a set of conditions over time that can change the psychology of where we are? How do you focus on the Palestinian side? Because you have to be able to ensure Israelis that a Palestinian state isn't going to be led by Hamas, isn't going to be led by extremists, isn't going to be part of the Iranian axis of resistance, isn't going to be a source of instability in the region, isn't going to be a failed state. Mm-hmm. All those things require building certain kinds of benchmarks, which take time. In my mind, they start with reforming the Palestinian Authority so that at some point it can come back to govern Gaza, because you need an alternative to Hamas. But on the other side, there also has to be an approach of the Israelis that, one, don't take steps that make a Palestinian state impossible. And two, if there is a reforming Palestinian Authority, you have to make life easier for it so that it has a chance to succeed and not fail.
What's the significance of Senator Chuck Schumer calling for early elections in Israel and for an end, frankly, to Bibi Netanyahu's prime ministership?
Well, I think what it reflects is a couple of things. One is the recognition of what the trend in terms of public opinion here is in the United States, and certainly within the Democratic Party. And I think he's, at one level, he was trying to get out front of them. But I think at another level, it reflected a very genuine frustration by someone who is one of the closest and strongest supporters of Israel, And though I know that in the near term, it probably produces a backlash within Israel, I hope that there'll be Israelis who will think about, gee, if we have a problem with someone like Chuck Schumer, given everything that he believes and is committed to with regard to Israel, then there are some positions we need to rethink. And I think more than anything else, to be fair in terms of what he was saying, he was really riveted on ministers Smotrich and Ben-Gavir, who are messianic nationalists and who are contributing to, I think, a perception of Israel that is an Israel that seems to be inconsistent with the values it's always embodied and with the values that have been, in a sense, one of the pillars of the U.S.-Israeli relationship.
We'll return to Ben-Gavir and Smotrich later in the hour, I'm sure, but let me ask you about the number of 30,000 plus. It's more than that now. Does that number of the claim of Palestinians who have been killed in the Israeli offensive, does that suggest to you, as I've read one columnist say, well, that's no different from what the U.S. did in fighting ISIS in Iraq or Syria? Or does it strike you, as President Biden described it, as being over the top, a sign that Israel has not taken enough care to protect civilians?
I think Israel has been faced with a really cruel dilemma, because if you were going to root out Hamas and you're going to demilitarize Hamas, which I think should be the basic objective, it had to deal with Hamas that built 400 miles of tunnels, a military industrial base underground, all of which reflected enormous acquisition of materials, proving that while Gaza may have been an open air prison for the people who lived there, it was not an open air prison for Hamas. And they used the public as shields. And in fact, they held their own population hostage. So the cruel dilemma was, you can't root them out, given how they use the population as human shields, without, unfortunately, there being a terrible price for the people who live in Gaza.
Yeah.
And if you don't do that and you don't root them out, then they get to stay. And in a sense, you just validated their strategy so they can do it again. I think where the Israelis have fallen short is less in terms of them trying to minimize the human casualties and much more in terms of how little they did as it related to trying to ensure from the very beginning there would be humanitarian assistance provided. They could have done much more there. They should have done much more there to make it clear this was about going after Hamas, not about punishing the Palestinians.
Yeah.
That would have
Dennis
given
Ross.
More time and space.
Dennis Ross, thank you. And stick around, because we'll have the discussion period in a few minutes. Our second panelist now is Reith Omari, who, in addition to his past role in Israeli-Palestinian diplomacy, is, like Dennis Ross, I should have said, affiliated with the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He's also the former executive director of the American Task Force on Palestine. Reith, thank you very much for joining us once again.
Always a pleasure to be with you, Robert.
Obviously, the war in Gaza has been catastrophic for the Palestinians. Is it fair to demand that a ceasefire on Israel's part be accompanied by a hostage release on Hamas's part?
I think it is absolutely fair. I mean, I think we have to distinguish between three different issues here. I do think that the Israeli objective of defeating Hamas, and as Dennis said, to disarm and dismantle Hamas's terror and the military capabilities is a very legitimate objective. No country can be expected to withstand what Israel withstood, such a terror attack on October 7th, and not to react. At the same time, the issue of hostages is one that needs to be dealt with. Look, the issue of a ceasefire at the end of the day, I think a permanent ceasefire will have to be linked with Hamas laying down its arms or be defeated, whichever comes first. Now, none of that obviates the need for Israel to be more mindful of the humanitarian aspect. And I think sometimes we conflate these kind of issues. I believe it is absolutely right to pursue a ceasefire linked to a hostage deal, but at the same time, continue pressure Israel to allow for humanitarian access and, frankly, to be more mindful in the way that it conducts its military operations. And I'm here of the view, similar to the one that President Biden has, that the civilian casualties are certainly, to quote him, over the top. But one can work on all of these together. I think today it is effect that Hamas is using the human suffering as a way of improving its leverage. And I think de-aggregating these different issues will actually reduce the leverage that Hamas has in these negotiations.
There's a lot of talk in Washington, at least, about the Palestinian Authority, a new reinvigorated, empowered Palestinian Authority, taking over in Gaza once the fighting stops. You worked with the Palestinian Authority 20 years ago. Do you think that a new PA would enjoy the support of Gazans? Would it need some outside security force to keep Hamas from seizing power? What might happen with the Palestinian Authority?
I mean, it really depends on what a new PA is. I mean, if a new PA is what we're seeing right now, you know, Abbas has just appointed one of his entourage to be prime minister. If the new PA is still linked and in the public imagination with the corruption, poor governance, failures, etc., that came with the original PA, then of course the people in Gaza, just like the people in the West Bank, will be fed up with it. I mean, polls show us today that more than 60% of the Palestinians believe that the PA is a burden, has to be abolished. On the other hand, if one can think of a new PA that is truly reformed, where corruption is rooted out, where efficiency is the name of the game, then certainly this is something that will capture public imagination. And we've seen it in the past when the PA reformed under former Prime Minister Salam Fayyad. We saw the standing of the PA increase in polling. Now, to the specific question that you asked about security, in the short term, I do not believe that the PA has the ability to secure Gaza. I mean, the PA's security forces right now are barely enough to secure the West Bank, and they've been doing a decent job on that one, but they can't, Gaza is a much more complicated situation. I believe that ultimately the PA has to be a reformed PA, has to be reintroduced into Gaza, but gradually based on its capabilities. In the meantime, I see no replacement for a combination of the Israelis as well as a third party playing some of the security roles in the interim.
I mean, the U.S. National Security Advisor, Jake Sullivan, in expressing concern about Palestinians who've evacuated to Rafah, has spoken of the other cities in Gaza, Gaza City and Khan Yunis, as destroyed. Gazans don't have a way out of Gaza, and there aren't cities where there used to be in Gaza, as best I can tell. I mean, do you have any sense of what rebuilding Gaza means? Does it mean 5 years of people living in tents before buildings can go up? What are we looking at here?
To be honest, Robert, I have no idea. I don't think we have ever seen anything like this in the past. I mean, we've seen destruction of cities in the past. You look at Mosul, you look at Raqqa, in the kind of anti-ISIS campaign. The difference there is that there were other places, whether in Iraq or in Syria, where the refugees could go and be there until there was rebuilding. In this case, we haven't seen it. And I believe this is one of the areas where there is least, let's say, developed thinking in the administration, in the policy community, in the UN, elsewhere. What we know is that it's going to take many years. So I think right now it's a question of how do you prioritize. And the first priority at the moment has to be dealing with the basic humanitarian needs, be they sanitation infrastructure, water, food, but also temporary shelter. But I think the long-term rebuilding in Gaza will take a long time, and it already will take a long time. But today, and I was just in the Middle East, in Arab countries and in Israel, and you talk to Arab countries, and you talk to Europeans, and they will tell you that they were not willing to put another penny into Gaza so to see it just being bombed again in the next war. So unless we see a real defeat for Hamas, two real steps towards, or convincing steps towards, a two-state solution, maybe not tomorrow, maybe not next year, but something valid, and a real reintroduction of a clean, effective, non-corrupt PA, I don't even see how the reconstruction is going to start, because I don't know who's going to pay for it.
Yeah. Yes, it's not an obvious future there. Reith Omari, thank you, and stick around for the Q&A session. Our third panelist now is Natan Sachs, who directs the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. Natan was educated at Hebrew University and at Stanford. His academic work has taken him to Tel Aviv University's Dayan Center. He's also taught at Georgetown University. Natan, welcome. It's good to see you once again.
Thank you very much for having me.
I've lost my place. In the past, you've described much of the Israeli public's attitude toward the Palestinians, this is pre-October 7th, as managing the status quo, or to use your word, anti-solutionist. It can't be solved. Let's get on to other issues instead. As they experience the war in Gaza, I'm just wondering which you think is going to be the lesson that anti-solutionists, as you would say, will take away with it. Is it, we told you so, there's no way you can ever possibly solve this conflict? Or is it, we took our eye off the ball. Yes, it's good to have relations with Morocco and Sudan, but we have to deal with this thing, this problem we have that the Palestinians are here.
Oh, thanks again for having me. I think it's a bit of both. Certainly the way most Israelis reacted to October 7th, unsurprisingly, is first with quite literal trauma. I hesitate to use that word in the context of a medical center, but I think it is actually probably an apt diagnosis for many people. And the reaction is deeply emotional, deeply personal. And in that sense, the very first reaction that I think every Israeli had watching what's happening in real time was of rallying around the flag, believing first and foremost that that may never happen again. And so we saw the words never again reemerge. Never again is now. I think that is more deeply held than many people outside Israel understand. There is a sense that no matter what international opprobrium Israelis face, they cannot allow a group like Hamas to govern a statelet bordering Israel and to threaten Israeli civilians on the border. And that would apply, of course, to Hezbollah in the north as well. In that regard, we see a dramatic move to the right, but it's to the right in the sense of security. Israelis unwilling to contemplate new risks for peace. You may recall Bill Clinton, whom Ambassador Ross worked very closely with, spoke of as Israel would take risks for peace, the United States would be with it. Well, those risks for peace are exactly what Israelis are loath to contemplate right now. Perhaps that will ease in a matter of months or years, but I doubt it. I think it's with us to stay. Moving to the right, however, on that does not necessarily mean moving to the right on questions of the land of Israel or on the potential theoretical compromise over it or on settlements. And so when they approach the question of solutions, yes, on the one hand, I think the feeling that there is no solution to this conflict or that there cannot be one that Israelis could countenance, could suffer the risks involved with, that has only strengthened. On the other hand, there is also a waking up from what is considered to be the conceptia or the paradigm, mm-hmm. faulty paradigm that led to this, that is to a large degree the idea that Hamas can be deterred or accommodated. But for many, it's also raising questions on what the previous years led to, what the approach of the Palestinians meant. So in short, I don't think, as Dennis said, I don't think this means a solution is any more available, quite to the contrary. But that does not necessarily mean a return to the same kind of conflict management that was before, which to my mind was not conflict management. It was letting the conflict manage you. It was sliding in the wrong direction, sometimes quite rapidly, and doing so consciously. So the question perhaps should be for us, for anyone hoping to move forward, is not can we achieve a solution immediately, but rather what kind of conflict management are we talking about? Can it be dramatically different than the one before? And that would include a dramatically different reality for Palestinians in the West Bank without security, new security risks that are simply will not be undertaken by Israel, and without an all or nothing approach that says if we cannot have a two-state solution soon or something else, then we simply cannot do anything.
You have a book in the works, I gather, with the title Endgame, Does Israel Have a Plan? And when I first saw that, I thought this could be the shortest book ever published. Is the answer no, or is there really, or is anyone in Israel thinking beyond the war in Gaza right now?
Well, two things. First, that book is now undergoing revision. It was actually completed before October 7th, and now, of course, I am revising some of it. And I'll note that in the book itself, I note that question, because I've got that many, many times. Is this the shortest book? Is it a pamphlet? Mm-hmm. The title now will be different, but the shorter answer is Israel has had many plans. It's had many plans over the years. And in fact, the one thing that many Israelis cannot agree on is the long-term objective of what the perfect solution would be. And as a result, a lot of the politics that we've seen have been compromises on means rather than on ends. That said, if you look at most Israelis, or at least most Israelis in the core of the body politic, they would be far less dogmatic about many of the things that they hold dear. So most Israelis, most Jewish Israelis hold dear the idea of the land of Israel. And yet many of them, most of them, under the right circumstances, would certainly countenance compromise on it. As I said, that compromise now would include far less risk tolerance than it did before.
Yeah.
There are those who do not, who would not countenance any compromise on the land of Israel. So in short, there are many plans. There's not just one plan. But if you look overall in the past 20-some years, Israelis, to my mind, have converged on some idea of managing the conflict. And a big question for us is not to forget that managing the conflict comes in many, many different forms. It can be kicking the can down the road in the completely wrong direction, which to my mind has sometimes characterized policy in recent years. It can be a different kind of conflict management, even taking seriously the low risk tolerance that Israelis had before October 7th and certainly since then.
In terms of Israel's relations with the countries who opened normal diplomatic relations with them under the Abraham Accords, it seems that all of them, whatever, however unpopular that opening may be now with their own people, they've stood by the Abraham Accords. Do the Israelis correctly see Hamas as a group that is despised by Arab countries as much as by them?
A very hard question. The short answer is by most Arab governments, yes. Most Arab governments despise Hamas, some of them for their own reasons, which are usually the strongest reasons. So certainly the government of Egypt has a very deep-seated and domestic motivation against Muslim Brotherhood organizations. First and foremost, the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood, which is the mother organization of Muslim Brotherhoods. And Hamas is the Palestinian Muslim Brotherhood. So in that sense, the Egyptian government despises Hamas. It also fears Hamas in terms of security in the Sinai, which of course abuts the Gaza Strip. That said, the Egyptian government and many others have relations with Hamas. Egypt, in fact, is one of the only countries with real leverage over Hamas, limited but real leverage over Hamas. And they are involved also in the negotiations in Paris and now in Doha. So if you look at governments, certainly most of them despise Hamas, not all. Qatar has had relations with them. Turkey, which is not an Arab country, of course, but Turkey has had close relations and in general with the Muslim Brotherhood organizations. Other Arab states, certainly the ones you mentioned from the Abraham Accords, starting with the UAE, but to a degree also the Saudis and others, have had very strained relations with Muslim Brotherhood organizations and with Hamas individually. However, we have to distinguish. Governments and publics are not the same thing. And the publics in the Middle East, certainly in the Arab world, but well beyond it, even here in the United States, are extremely motivated by the last few months. This is a level of politicization, even by people who are simply not very politically involved, and certainly not involved in this conflict, a very high level of politicization and of polarization around this. And so I'm very concerned also in terms of the long-term politics and diplomacy of this. There are many governments, even in non-democratic states, that have to take into account public opinion, and that public opinion has dramatically worsened in the past few months and is not getting better as we speak. That's going to be a major variable we have to take into account. For a country like the UAE, with very few citizens, it's less of a concern. With a country with more citizens like Saudi Arabia, it's more of a concern, although limited. It is an absolute monarchy. For other countries, it can be far more concerning. Jordan, first among them, although with Leith on the call, I certainly will not be the one to speak about Jordan.
Natan Sachs, thank you. Stay with us now. And I want to bring back Dennis Ross and Leith Amari to begin our discussion period. And I want to put to all three of you, I guess, a thought that came to me. Dennis Ross mentioned Itamar Ben-Gvir and Bezalel Smotrich, two extreme rightist ministers in the Netanyahu government who permit Netanyahu to have a majority. One of them mentioned that he thought that there should be the Palestinian population of Gaza should be reduced to 200,000 or something like that recently. And I believe that Netanyahu distanced himself from that idea. But thinking of how displaced the people of Gaza are and what little accommodation there is for people who are living there, I'm just wondering, is one possible outcome of this war another mass emigration, another mass migration of Palestinians out of where they have been. I mean, Reith, can you imagine if you're trying to get 2.2 million people inside a dwelling and fed and cared for medically, with no hospitals working and no buildings? Is it a moment when more Palestinians leave, when the extremist agenda, in effect, wins out?
I mean, look, this is the worst nightmare and the biggest fear of many of the Arab countries, as well many in the Palestinian national movement. I mean, when people listen to Ben-Gvir or Smotrich or many of the other characters in the Israeli government talking about that, the term that you hear in Arabic media among Arabic officials is, this is the second Nakba.
Second Nakba. This 1948, and now yes. This is what they're saying.
I mean, and this is a concern, and this is really part of the reason why, for example, Egypt today is not allowing Palestinians from Gaza into Egypt. Now, there are many reasons, but one of the reasons is a concern is that they leave and they're not allowed to go back. The same in Jordan. You know, it's no surprise that Jordan is saying expulsion of Palestinians or even quote-unquote voluntary migration, i.e. you create impossible situation. That's a red line. Because I think, you know, people here in the outside, and certainly people in Israel, do not really appreciate the kind of since we use the word trauma, the traumatic association of mass migration of Palestinians has in the Arab imagination and certainly in the Palestinian imagination. So we find ourselves in this impossible situation where people are stuck there without the infrastructure, yet the idea of migration has become so anathema that anyone who's pushing for it right now is certainly touching on some very nervous buttons in Egypt, Jordan, and elsewhere in the Arab world.
So, Dennis, one of the givens then is that 2.2 million people will remain in this somewhat smaller than Manhattan strip along the Mediterranean without their homes standing?
Well, I think, look, the short answer is yes, and for the reasons that Ray said. I mean, when he talks about in the Arab and the Palestinian imagination, there is a sense that they will not allow Israel to solve the Palestinian problem by expulsion. And that's what the great fear is, that that's what this would represent. So they're not going to leave. It's not like in Syria, we had 5.5 million people leave. We had 5.5 million people internally displaced. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't the issue that in an Arab war, their people can't leave. They did. And Riz said earlier on the issue of, if you go to Mosul, Mosul was leveled when we fought ISIS. Same with Raqqa, but people could leave. Here they can't leave. So the answer is you need the Gulf states in particular to fund an awful lot of prefab housing, not just tents, but prefab housing. There's a lot of prefab housing that can be moved in very quickly if you have the kind of pause that makes it possible to get not only a lot of assistance in, but you have a kind of distribution system working at the same time.
And Nathan Sachs, thoughts on this?
I think, you know, what Leith described is fundamental, and it's fundamental to the question of Egypt in particular, which is a key player in all of this. I think we have to assume that the some million people in Gaza will remain, and the conditions are terrible. In the long term, the natural opening would be to the West Bank. That is where Gazans and West Bankers share identity and share what they see as a future. Of course, it would not mean moving anyone from one side to the other, but opening the possibility for movement there would be the long-term answer. The problem in the short term or the medium term is the governance structure. So long as Hamas is partly in control in the Gaza Strip, so long as the security situation in the West Bank remains as precarious as it is today, and it is extremely so, this kind of connection remains impossible. In the long term, that is the only way forward. And we should hope for the Palestinian Authority that partially governs part of the West Bank to have more authority in the Gaza Strip and to lead eventually towards reunification of these two territories.
Here's a question submitted by a viewer. What are some baby steps for Palestinians and Israelis on the West Bank to any kind of coexistence, even the most basic? Dennis.
Look, I think one of the places you start is if you have reform in the Palestinian Authority, which is, Ray said, the current appointment of Mohammed Mustafa doesn't give one a level of confidence if that's what you're going to see. But if there is reform in the West Bank, that becomes a basis on which the administration can go to the Israelis and say, you have an obligation. We have a reforming Palestinian Authority. You have an obligation to make life easier for them, whether it's movement, whether it's allowing Palestinian goods to be sold in Israel, whether it's turning over tax revenues. I mean, there's a whole series of things that Israel could do to make life easier, among others, obviously, stop building, stop expanding settlements, because that just continues to erode any credibility that even if you have a reforming Palestinian Authority, it can begin to improve governance. But if it looks like it's completely powerless vis-a-vis the Israelis, it will limit how much credibility they can build.
I have a question, Natan Sachs, for you about something that you told me I'd never known before. But I'd always assumed, like a lot of Americans, that the Israeli prime minister, analogous to the American president, is the commander-in-chief of the Israeli Defense Forces. He isn't, evidently, under what I guess what isn't quite a constitution, but substitutes for one in Israel. This could become relevant, indeed, if there's an intense argument over what to do in Rafah between the U.S. and the Israeli leadership. Who is the commander-in-chief of the IDF?
So the IDF, the Israel Defense Forces, and its commander, the chief of staff, answer to the government as a whole, meaning the cabinet, represented by the Minister of Defense. And in that sense, the Minister of Defense actually has some priority over the prime minister. And in certain times in history, he did. So in 1967, for example, Moshe Dayan was the Minister of Defense, and he ran the show sometimes against the will of the prime minister, Levi Eshkol. The cabinet as a whole is very large. And so for many years now, the authority of commander-in-chief has been bestowed on a smaller cabinet known as the security cabinet that includes several members, including by law also the justice minister, but also the minister of the police, or now it's called national security, the finance minister. Those two last that I mentioned, the finance minister and the minister of national security or the police, are Bezalel Smotrich and Itamar Ben-Gvir, the very far right. And so when this war began, a new mechanism was set up essentially to exclude them and to bring in figures from the opposition, in particular Benny Gantz and Gadi Eisenkot from the center parties. They were brought in and a new mini war cabinet was created. So right now, if you ask me who is literally in command of the military, it is technically three people as a council equally: Benjamin Netanyahu, prime minister, Yoav Gallant, the minister of defense, and Benny Gantz, who's a minister without portfolio, with three observers: Gadi Eisenkot, Ron Dermer, the former ambassador, Benjamin Netanyahu, and Aryeh Deri, who's the longest veteran minister of Shas, from the Shas party. They are the ones running the show. Bezalel Smotrich and Itamar Ben-Gvir have no authority over the IDF. You can sometimes see tweets by them reacting to reports in the press that X, Y, or Z is happening, and you would wonder how it is that they don't simply ask the prime minister in their next meeting. The answer is that they're simply not privy to any information. There's one important caveat to that. Jerusalem, of course, under Israeli law, is part of Israel. It's not in the territories and is not under the jurisdiction of the military at all. And therefore, it is governed, of course, by the civilian government, but via the Minister of the Police, now called, as I said, the Minister of National Security. That is Itamar Ben-Gvir. A small part of his authority has been taken over by the war cabinet, the authority to limit who goes up to Temple Mount, Haram al-Sharif, during Ramadan now. But nonetheless, he's in charge of it, of the police, and that includes the border police. That is very worrying. During Ramadan, this is a clash point, especially border police as opposed to the blue police, as they're known. This is a real question, and one that in the next few weeks of Ramadan is one that to all of our minds, I think, should be quite concerning.
Here's a question. Both the questions I'm asking you are sent in by anonymous attendees. And I'll expand this one. The questioner asks, is Netanyahu using the war in Gaza as a wedge to help elect Donald Trump? I'll broaden that to say, what is the relationship between Israeli politics and American presidential politics right now? Dennis Ross.
How about in one word? Complicated.
Okay.
I mean, look, there is if you ask me to Does Bibi Netanyahu want Donald Trump to be president? I'm not so sure. Donald Trump wasn't so happy with him when he quickly recognized the election of Joe Biden. Donald Trump makes it very clear he's all about retribution. He doesn't hide that. So I'm not so sure there's a desire to see Donald Trump as president. I think there probably is a sense that given the politics of an election period, that pushing back when there's a pressure from the administration probably is seen as constraining what an administration will do. But I think we're also dealing in a reality where, you know, the president of the United States also realizes that he's paying a certain price for support for Israel among his own base within the Democratic Party. And he's also balancing what he thinks is the right thing to be done. And he clearly is moved by the humanitarian cost within Gaza. So he's balancing the right thing to be done with also trying to show that he's taking steps that can affect some of those within his own party who make up his base that I think need to be addressed. Now, I would also say I read Senator Schumer's speech as also taking into account very much domestic currents here, domestic drift here, the reality within the Democratic Party, and making it clear that as the leader in the Senate, he's mindful of this and mindful of the views of his own caucus. And he has staked out a position that gives him credibility, I think, on this issue by what he had to say, at least in terms of his own Democratic caucus in the Senate.
Reith Omari, if in fact Hamas is kept out of any opportunity to become a leading party in Palestinian politics, and if people are suspicious of the Palestinian Authority perhaps being the same old Palestinian Authority, who are leaders whom Palestinians acknowledge and respect and have some confidence in?
These days, not many. And it is a function. I mean, it's not because of the lack of talent or capability among the Palestinians. We all know Palestinians. We all know that that's a rich society when it comes to this. But you've had a political system, particularly under President Abbas, that basically has not allowed for leaders to emerge. Today, the system is not, you know, if you're an effective minister, you get pushed aside because you're building a base. If you're a popular prime minister, like the one I mentioned before, Salam Fayyad, you get moved away, etc. So I think in the short term, today, we will have to find some consortium of leaders who appeal to various constituencies, mainly from the Fatah movement, but are not affiliated with the Palestinian Authority. You can think of people like, former foreign minister Nasser Kidwa, exiled Fatah leader Mohammed Dahlan, who's still popular in Gaza, and people like this. You need to have a technocratic face, someone who can actually manage, be it someone like Fayyad. There are other names that you can think of out there. But in the medium and longer term, we have to also, I mean, this is part of why reform is so essential, to allow leaders to emerge as people who can say, I served as a minister of X or a minister of Y, and look what a great job I did. To allow people to have a politics based on performance, not only on slogans. Today, the system does not allow it. Reformed Palestinian Authority can produce that. In the meantime, it will be very important for whoever comes to govern next, whatever constellation, to have the kind of top cover from the Arab world. I think this is one area where you should have concerted Arab messaging, as well as Arab diplomatic and other kind of support for these leaders, to say that these are Palestinian leaders who we have as Arab leaders have trust on, that they can manage and then ultimately achieve the Palestinian national objectives. I think short of that, we will have a degree of political vacuum, because even if Hamas is sidelined, it will continue to have impact, and it will mobilize its supporters against something like this. Even if Abbas is sidelined, he will continue to do this. So we need this consortium, but also we need a very strong Arab coalition behind it. And this is something that should be, in my mind at least, on one of the top of the priority of the administration's approach to the Arab world, and basically saying, we want to see an Arab coalition that will shepherd the Palestinians during the next transitional periods.
And on one of my reporting trips to Gaza, this one was just as the PA was about to come in and start administering Gaza, The housing problem is so glaring that I happened to meet the Palestinian Authority's housing minister, and I asked him something that I'd heard from an Israeli Palestinian who really wanted to build new cities for Palestinians and wanted to pave over the camps. I said, "Well, can you imagine paving over the camps and building good housing for people?" And the minister told me, "This is a political question. See, this is a political matter." And what he meant was, as I understand it, was that the situation of Palestinians in Gaza is terrible, but if one is not a refugee, one gives up the moral claim that we still haven't settled the war of 1948. And as a result, people must remain refugees. And as a result, we must have things that we call refugee camps, even as they had the complete appearance of just being urban slums. You're nodding, so I guess I'm not that far off, right?
You're not that far off. And I think, you know, the issue of the refugee identity is so embedded in Palestinian national identity. And I think personally, I mean, this is my very personal view, is that in the long term or in the medium term, the Palestinians should move away from this kind of victim-based mentality. By the way, that's one of the reasons I keep on going to this guy, Salam Fayyad. One of the reasons why I always admired him as a leader, because he was someone who said, stop with the victimhood, and as Palestinians, no matter how bad things are, we can do things for ourselves. All of that said, I don't believe that when you're in the middle of a war, when there are so many priorities, is that this is the time to start tackling some of these very complicated issues. I mean, you know, Dennis had tried, I had tried when I was a negotiator, many of us had tried to resolve these issues in much better times, and we understand how complex they are. Right now, I think I would start with the lowest hanging fruit. If I want to talk about reconstruction, etc., I would talk about the less politically sensitive ones. I have very, by the way, similar views when it comes to UNRWA, a deeply flawed organization, but this is not the time to start dismantling it when you're in the middle of a war. The one, I guess, footnote I would put here is that because of the amount of destruction in Gaza that's happening right now, this might be a moot question because reconstruction is going to happen everywhere. And this might be an interesting time to rebuild Gaza without these urban slums and actually do it this way. And here again, I would say, I think the Arab world can play a very interesting role. I mean, many of us think of the Arab world as an ATM, which is the way that they were in the past. But today, if you look at the successes we see in the UAE, in Saudi Arabia, etc., I think these are countries that can play not only a financing role, but also a management, governance, infrastructure, reconstruction role directly. So I think we have an interesting opportunity here. Maybe these countries can deal with these complex issues in ways that are less sensitive than if us from the West, from the US and elsewhere, come and try to deal with these issues.
Natan Sachs, in the months prior to October 7th, there were regular huge protest demonstrations against Bibi Netanyahu and his plan to curtail the powers of the Supreme Court of Israel and some other changes. Has the war eliminated that movement? I know, obviously, people rallied together when they were mobilized, but is that in the past, or does it remain a limitation on Netanyahu that so many people oppose his leadership?
It remains a huge limitation, and it's part of the background to his polling numbers, which are deep underwater. The immediate, of course, impetus for that is his responsibility as prime minister on October 7th, which caused a huge backlash in a sense among most Israelis that he should not continue as prime minister. It limits his ability, and it limits his ability in particular because already on October 8th, we saw one natural reaction would have been to jettison the very controversial coalition that he had. And the top agenda for that was a deep change, revolution in the constitutional makeup between the judiciary and the legislature. And instead to go for a national unity government with Benny Gantz and others from the center, perhaps even the left. He did not do that because he felt politically, and from the political standpoint, he was correct, that if he did that, he would eventually remain without the center and without the far right that was buttressing it. So he refused to give up the far right. He said, if I do so, I won't have my 64, which is the number of coalition members he
64 had. 64 seats out of 120 in the Knesset.
Exactly, out of 120. So a majority, not a very large one, but a clear majority in the Knesset. Now he has more than 64. So it constrains him in that sense that he is more beholden to the far right than he would be by logic. Coalition is not, you know, it's not law. You can change coalitions. You could move things. And Netanyahu has done so many times in the past. But now, given his lack of popularity and given the background of the last several years and the political crisis around it, he reckons and correctly that he, without the far right, he would have no political base. Some critics might argue that even so, politics should not be guiding him in the deepest moment of crisis of the country. But critics would be speaking a different language than Netanyahu.
Question from a listener: what are the goals of the Palestinians? And I'll amplify that: is the notion of a two-state solution something like what was on the table when Raith and Dennis were last negotiating, and when John Kerry was negotiating, or is it still the Palestine will be free from the river to the sea? Raith, what do Palestinians want?
I mean, this is like asking me, what do the Israelis want? I don't think there is, you know, what the Palestinians want. We have a divided and different points of view. The two-state solution still has a constituency, a diminishing one, and it's a minority today, but still a plurality, I believe. There are those who want to destroy Israel, and Hamas is definitely the poster child, and it goes beyond Hamas. But to be honest, most Palestinians today are, I believe, have given up hope and just don't see any way forward. But public opinion can change very quickly. I mean, I could have given the exact same statement, a week before Oslo was signed. But when you saw a real change, a real diplomatic move that gave people hope, public opinion shifted in that way. So today, look, in the middle of a war, I think anger and revenge continue to be, I mean, they are what define the mood. But I think longer term, public opinion can be led in where leaders are. Here, I would just add two quick notes. Again, I go back to the point of why it's so essential to reform the Palestinian Authority, because without leaders who can guide public opinion, I believe that anger would continue to rule. That's one. And two, even if we get to the best case scenario where we can have leaders and rehabilitate the idea of a two-state solution, Palestinians will not turn into Zionists. And I think we have to reconcile ourselves that, the peace that we've been talking all about will look more like a divorce than it would look like a marriage. But certainly a divorce in that context is much better than an active conflict, which is what we've been seeing for the last decades.
And Dennis Ross, I'll put, a last question to you. Perhaps this is my imagination overworking, but many years ago, the Yom Kippur War of 1973 revealed the clay feet of Israel's leaders, and Israel's leaders were defined as the left of center labor movement, all Ashkenazim. 4 years later, there was an election, and I'm not saying that it was the only cause by any means, but the frustrations of North African Jews and their loss of confidence in the government was such that they en masse abandoned the center-left for the right and the Likud party, which Bibi Netanyahu has been the leader of for the past, I don't know how many years. Is there any possibility of that kind of seismic shift in Israeli political behavior or thinking as the result of this war? Can you imagine public opinion changing in some radical way in the way in which it changed in 1977?
I do think that there are differences from that period, because a lot of those who then voted for Likud, they were voting against what they saw as an elite dominance of the society, corruption they saw within the elite, and them being treated almost as an underclass within the country. And Menachem Begin knew how to play on that. He was an outsider, even though he had little in common with them. From a social level, he was also an outsider who they connected with. I don't think you have quite the same today, but I think also the society has obviously changed since that time. I do think what's similar is you had a seismic shock, and you basically had Likud and the right in power for a long time. And I think that produces the potential for a big change. And I don't know that you're going to see it all at once, but you put the right time frame in mind. I don't think we're going to see the same thing. I don't think we're going to see the same kind of government. I think it's interesting, Natan said quite correctly, the country has moved to the right on security, but I think they've moved to the center in terms of the kind of governance they want. I think they've seen a far-right, ultra-religious government, and they realize it was not only incompetent, but they also see that it presided over disaster. To think that that's not going to produce a big change politically in Israel, I think is to ignore the reality. So whether we're going to see all of it at once, probably not, but the same time frame, 73 to 77, maybe less than that, I think you're going to see something that is equivalent to that in terms of the change in the political makeup and balance of power within Israel.
Well, Ambassador Dennis Ross, thank you. Also, Reith Omari and Natan Sachs, thank you all for taking part in this very interesting discussion. Many thanks as well to Joshua Plout and Ronnie Givigliano of American Friends of Rabin Medical Center, which produces Global Connections. And thanks to our technical director, Bobby Grandone. Our program sponsor, the American Friends of Rabin Medical Center, is a 501c3 national charitable organization. It represents in the United States Israel's largest hospital, Rabin Medical Center in Petah Tikva, in the greater Tel Aviv area. I'm Robert Siegel. This has been Global Connections, Navigating the New Normal. See you next month. Stay healthy and stay safe.